There was a feeling that herd immunity had somehow been acquired. This was absolutely a misconception.
India endures second COVID wave. It's Thursday, April 8th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us online. Visit VOA Asia on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Rohingyas out of Myanmar military's line of fire. For now, sharing COVID vaccines, police brutality on trial, adopting and modernizing your pet, funny Chinese women. It's all on today's VOA Asia. India has been recording the highest numbers of COVID-19 cases in the world as it grapples with a second wave of the pandemic. As Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi, the impact of the massive surge of the virus, despite India being the world's biggest vaccine maker, will be felt far beyond its shores as India slows vaccine shipments to other countries.
A packed marketplace in Mumbai, just days before India's financial capital hit record high infections. A month-long religious festival that sees hundreds take a dip in the river Ganges daily. People without masks at huge political rallies being held in five states holding local elections. Many in India stopped following COVID protocols as cases dropped earlier this year. The price? A second wave that has climbed more swiftly than the first, making India the world's COVID-19 hotspot.
There was a general feeling of comfort across all sections, including the policymakers and particularly the public, that we had seen the end of the epidemic. And there was a feeling that herd immunity had somehow been acquired, and that was going to protect India from any further inroads of the virus. This was absolutely a misconception.
As the country's daily tally crossed 100,000 cases this week, worst affected regions such as Maharashtra state reimposed restrictions. Its capital, Mumbai, shut down shops, restaurants and beaches and imposed a weekend curfew. Delhi has imposed a night curfew. That is worrying the millions who had returned to casual jobs in cities that had resumed normal life after a stringent lockdown.
Last year, we had no work for 6 to 7 months. We were all sitting at home. Only we know how we coped.
To stem the rapid rise of infections, India has boosted its inoculation drive. Health officials this month have begun targeting the younger age group, believed to be driving the rising numbers. There is still a long way to go. Although the more than 87 million jabs administered so far are among the largest in the world, they account for less than 7% of the population. To meet its massive need, India has slowed down vaccine deliveries to countries from Indonesia to Africa that are critically dependent on the world's largest vaccine producer. Amid concern that the temporary hold will impact rollouts in many developing countries, India has defended its decision.
We have supplied vaccines to more than 80 countries across the world. We have already stated that our external supplies would be done, keeping in mind our domestic requirements. At this time, I'm sure our partners understand that vaccines are primarily purposed for domestic consumption.
India's second wave could determine the course of the pandemic, not just in the vast South Asian nation, but other countries too. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
There's much more on this story. You can see it on voanews.com and follow us on our social media platforms like Twitter and Facebook. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Myanmar security forces kill 11 protesters. China sentences two ex-Xinjiang officials to death on separatism charges. China warns Washington not to boycott Winter Olympics. Vietnam joins opposition to Chinese activity near disputed sea reef. John Kerry takes U.S. climate change message to Asia. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories, video, text, and photos all on our website at voanews.com and on social media like Facebook at VOA Asia. continue with VOA Asia, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Myanmar's military government, seen as the chief force behind previous long-term violence against the Rohingya Muslim minority, is leaving the population alone for now as it battles protesters. But those following events closely say the junta is expected to resume the old crackdown over time. The junta seized power in a February coup from a civilian government and has been focused on quelling protesters rather than the Rohingya minority that lives in a western region of Myanmar and continues to push for civil rights. Tatanin Pongsudhirak, a political science professor at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok, says the Tatmadaw, which refers to the armed forces in the Myanmar language, has not changed its overall view.
The Tatmadaw is not going to change its policy towards the Rohingyas. Right now, it's just preoccupied. I think it has been consumed by other crises, and it's actually facing a nationwide revolt against the coup. So I think the Rohingya issue now is on a back burner.
Last year, the United Nations International Court of Justice said Myanmar officials had targeted the Rohingyas in a systematic way. It said genocidal acts, including mass murder, rape, and setting fires, were intended to wipe out the group, and cited a hardening crackdown since August 2017. Civilian governments ran Myanmar from 2011 through this past January, but the military still held sway in national affairs. The Rohingya issue tainted the international reputation of Aung San Suu Kyi, a one-time opposition figure and the de facto head of state from 2016 through February. She remains detained after the coup. An estimated 400,000 to 600,000 Rohingya live in Myanmar today. In January last year, the International Court of Justice ordered Myanmar to take all measures within its power to prevent any acts of genocide against the Rohingya people. But Thun Kyin, president of the advocacy group Burmese Rohingya Organization UK, said he is worried the military government will eventually try to eliminate all Rohingyas in the country. He estimates 82% of the population has already fled Myanmar.
I don't trust this military because this is the military, the architect of genocide of Rohingya for so long.
Roughly 1 million Rohingyas who have fled the camps in Bangladesh live there now in poverty. Priscilla Clapp, former permanent charge d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Myanmar, told VOA in June the plight of the refugees distracts view from what the military is doing.
Most people outside don't realize how serious it is. They're all fixated on the Rohingya issue.
Myanmar, also known as Burma, has had a long history of strife with the Muslim Rohingya dating back to the alliance between the Rohingya and Myanmar's former colonizer, Britain, who fought together against a local Buddhist group. After Myanmar became independent in 1948, the government of the largely Buddhist country denied the Rohingya people citizenship. The military led Myanmar from 1962 to 2011. We thank Ralph Jennings in Taipei for contributing this story. Happening now in Asia, rescue workers in Thailand freed a Buddhist monk trapped inside a flooded cave after he went inside to meditate. The monk was on a pilgrimage from another province and had entered the Phra Sai Nam cave on Saturday. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope your day is off to a great start. At least it is with us at VOA Asia. Thanks for being here. As the United States nears reaching its goal of vaccinating 200 million Americans by the end of April, the Biden administration is taking more steps toward helping other nations by appointing a coordinator for its global COVID-19 response. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Suara tells us more.
By April 19th, all adults in the U.S. will be eligible to get the vaccine, announced President Joe Biden, 2 weeks earlier than his original May 1st deadline.
We're now administering an average of 3 million shots per day, over 20 million shots a week. On Saturday alone, we reported more than 4 million shots were administered. We're the first country to administer 150 million shots and the first country to fully vaccinate over 62 million people.
Under pressure from other countries to share vaccines, earlier this week, Biden appointed Gail Smith as coordinator for the administration's global COVID-19 response. Smith is a global health expert who has advocated for shipping surplus vaccines abroad.
American leadership is desperately needed, and I'm extremely confident we can rise to the occasion.
While many lower and middle income countries have begun inoculating with Chinese vaccines and doses coming from COVAX, the UN's global vaccine sharing mechanism, experts say there is still a lot the U.S. can do beyond providing surplus doses.
It can help grow manufacturing capacity as a goal. It can bring order and transparency to a vaccine marketplace around the world that is untransparent, chaotic, and unaccountable at the moment.
On Tuesday, Biden also visited a vaccination site at a chapel in Virginia. His administration has launched a coalition of religious and community leaders to help persuade Americans reluctant to get vaccinated, around 20% according to polls. Americans are also increasingly defying health protocols, including many who celebrated a college basketball victory earlier this week.
We have over 60,000 new cases occurring every day, and younger adults now are the vectors. They are spreading this virus. They're going to ball games. They're going to restaurants and bars.
According to the White House, about 40% of adults in the U.S. have received at least one dose, and almost 20% of the total population is fully vaccinated. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello anytime you're online or on your smartphone. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime.
This news from VOA Asia. Local officials say the death toll from mudslides in eastern Indonesia has risen to 126, with scores still missing, as rain continues to pound the region and hamper the search. East Flores District on Andanara Island suffered the highest losses, with 67 bodies recovered so far. Find updates and breaking news on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue with VOA Asia, the death of George Floyd last year sparked protests across the United States and around the world in response to police brutality. The case against the white former Minneapolis police officer involved has gone to trial and is now in its second week. Prosecutors continued to make their case against defendant Derek Chauvin. VOA's Isha Sarai has more.
Employees of the Minneapolis Police Department echoed statements by their chief that Derek Chauvin's neck restraint of George Floyd, which he sustained for over 9 minutes, was not consistent with the department's training.
And so if there was, say, for example, the subject was under control and handcuffed, would this be authorized?
I would say no.
Under cross-examination by Chauvin's attorney, Mercel testified that officers are trained in some situations to use their knee across the suspect's back or shoulder and employ their body weight to maintain control. But he specified that
we tell officers to stay away from the neck when possible.
Officers detailed the training that Chauvin received during his time on the force, including courses on de-escalation and basic first aid. Also on the stand was a use of force expert who deemed that Chauvin's actions against Floyd were excessive.
What is your opinion as to the degree of force used by the defendant on Mr. Floyd on the date in question?
My opinion was that the force was excessive.
Medical professionals who testified earlier said Floyd had likely died due to a lack of oxygen. Defense attorneys say Floyd died of unrelated medical issues and drug use. The trial is expected to last several weeks. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
Making headlines in Asia, Hirofumi Yoshimura, the governor of Japan's Osaka Prefecture, declared a medical state of emergency in the area as a surge of coronavirus cases have put a strain on the local healthcare system. Yoshimura said he was alarmed by the fast-spreading new variants. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, ever since the pandemic lockdown began in the United States in March 2020, the pet adoption business has been booming. But the trend has not just been good for the animals. Licia Bakalitz has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
This Labrador retriever named Olive doesn't like the cameras, barks nervously, and looks at her owner protectively. Olive was adopted 2 months ago.
I had a lab puppy for about 14 years. Unfortunately, lost her to cancer at the beginning of the pandemic last year, so around end of January. But literally almost a year to this day is when I found Olive, or I should say Olive found me.
A local group of volunteers helped Shaila Manyam find Olive and later adopt her. The whole process took over 6 months, but Manyam knew from the very beginning she wanted to adopt Olive and give her a forever home.
So I think I got the call on like a Thursday, I think they agreed to sort of wait till Saturday when I could drive out to the shelter to see her. But yeah, if I hadn't taken her, I know there would have been another, you know, really wonderful family that would have loved to have had her too.
The pet adoption boom that started in March 2020 after the pandemic hit the country never subsided. Quarantines and lockdown measures made it a great time to get a pet.
We have not seen any change. People are still really excited about adoption, really excited about fostering, dogs and cats.
Humane Rescue Alliance is one of the oldest animal shelters in the Washington, D.C. area. And while in early spring of 2020 they had 30 dogs in their shelter, this year it's half the number. For many, having a pet at home means invaluable emotional support for them or their children.
We have had several adoptions of like small dogs that were adopted to be emotional support animals for kids with autism or some other kind of, PTSD or some other issue that they really needed help with.
Others just want the company. Julie Rukovkina, who has been self-quarantining for months, says without her Chihuahua, the experience would have been a lot more difficult.
I could always, snuggle with it. He likes to snuggle. He's always kind of next to you or on top of you, so...
In the past year, several of Rukovkina's friends followed her example and adopted dogs from a shelter. And volunteers are happy to report that despite fears that many animals would be returned with the relaxation of lockdown measures, that never happened. For Lesia Bokalets in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Once you have adopted a pet, perhaps consider a smart collar that can tell your pet's emotional state to toys that automatically move. In addition to greater adoptions, the pet tech industry is also growing, and that's largely because many people are staying at home during the pandemic. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more on the latest tech devices for pets.
Have you ever wondered what your dog's bark means?
Yes, I do. I do ever so want the ball.
While a doggy translator may only be possible in this world, this Petpol smart collar may be the next closest thing in the real world. Julie Chang's dog wears a Petpol smart collar.
When he's barking, you can see the different emotions that he has.
Using voice recognition technology and machine learning, the Korean company has collected a global database of canine barks from different breeds. Sound engineers and dog behavior experts worked with Seoul National University to develop the algorithm to analyze barks. A microphone in the collar records the bark, then a server analyzes the sound, but maintains the privacy of human conversations, says Andrew Gill of Petpols.
We have an algorithm saying that if human voice was being collected, our main server terrifies that's a noise, then it's not going to analyze it.
What the algorithm determines is the dog's emotion, which shows up on the app. That's how Chang knows how happy is feeling.
The different gauges of anger, or anxiety, or sad, or being happy, you can really kind of get a better idea to at least approach him differently.
The Chinese company Cheerable developed this self-driving ball and bone so dogs and cats stay entertained when they're home alone. This smart bone can also be controlled through an app with a virtual joystick. High-tech pet products like these are possible because of the ability to connect everyday objects to the internet and apps on mobile devices, says Seven Xie of Cheerable.
This was not possible even 10 years ago, but it can be realized today.
Stephen Koning researches trends at the Consumer Technology Association.
Wearables has just taken off and is not just for humans anymore.
With pet tech being a $500 million market in the U.S. alone, industry researchers say pet owners will spare no expense to keep their fur babies happy.
Let's go.
Elizabeth Lee, VOA News.
Stand-up comedy, long a form of entertainment in the West, has taken major strides toward acceptance in China. But as VOA's Ira Melman reports, most of those performing have been men until recently.
If we women want so much special treatment, then what's the difference between us and men?
Her stage name is Chi Chi. She's 23 years old and one of the growing number of female stand-up comedians in China. A web series is being credited by many for that growth. The streaming show called Rock and Roast has racked up hundreds of millions of views over the past few months in China and has made several female stand-up comedians viral sensations in only three seasons. Among those gaining such fame is Yang Mei. The 27-year-old left her job in the film industry to perform stand-up comedy full-time.
In the past, there were not so many women who made voices heard. In recent years, after the liberation of women, what was originally suppressed has been released. I think girls are natural performers because we've been considerate of men's thoughts and feelings since we were little.
But being a female stand-up comic in China is not an easy task. Jesse Appel is an American who moved to China to learn Mandarin and study comedy there. He has now become one of China's most popular stand-up comics.
It's definitely a challenge for the female comedians in China. I think part of the challenge is there aren't as many of them as there are male comedians, so there's less people to follow. So, you know, figuring out a way to get through and learn how to do this craft that's a new craft for Chinese people when you don't have the luxury of looking at people like you that have done it before. That's a challenge for women.
There are cultural challenges as well. Comedian Chi Chi incorporates swear words in many of her routines. She says she received a message from a male audience member complaining about that and recalls reading that message.
Swearing on the stage doesn't mean you're humorous. It only means that you are vulgar and cheap. I'm thinking, like, how should I put it? Why can't women swear?
Fellow comedian Yang Mei says audiences don't like female comedians swearing, but see men swearing as normal. Maybe because, she says, they think women are supposed to be more obedient. However, these female comedians' efforts to break cultural barriers and tackle gender taboos have not gone unnoticed. Yu Ruming is a regular member of the audience at female comedy shows.
One of the biggest characteristics of female comedians is that they dare to laugh at themselves. The self-mockery of female comedians is more attractive than that of males.
Other male audience members, such as Chen Rui, like the way women performers relate to their audience.
I think it's good for female comedians to talk about gender equality. It's a very important social topic.
American comedian Jesse Appel says female stand-up comics in China are here to stay.
Good thing that we've seen, though, is that when the female comedians get the big stage time on the big shows, they do collect an audience and people do like it. Even though there are some haters out there, there are a lot more people that are not haters and supporters and that go and follow the female comedians.
Ira Melman, VOA News, Washington.
We're glad, as always, to have had you with us today on VOA Asia. We invite you to come back tomorrow at the same time. In the meantime, you can follow us online. We're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. And you may stream or download our program at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our team, Managing Editor Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.